The Tom Woods Show, episode 2259.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. We all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, folks, Tom Woods here. I'm delighted to welcome back our friend Tim Moen, former leader of the Libertarian Party of Canada. He ran for prime minister. When was that? 2015, did you say?
Yeah, 2015, I ran. You know, I kind of popularized, hijacked. I think it was Austin. I can't remember his name, but he came up with the slogan, "I want gay married couples to protect their marijuana plants with guns." And I guess you could say I kind of popularized that. That was my campaign slogan, or one of the memes that we put out that went viral and got me a lot of attention kind of across the country and worldwide.
Well, you're also a firefighter paramedic, so you're able to look a little bit more closely at the inner workings of the Canadian healthcare system than the average person is able to. And that's given you a whole bunch of insights. Now, we do want to talk in this conversation about what we've been reading these days in the United States, actually, about the state-assisted suicide program. But let's start, first of all, we're coming off the craziness of nearly 3 years. It's just astonishing even to reflect on that. That it's been nearly three years. It's also astonishing, I might say, in parentheses, that Canada, when it comes to international travel, has suddenly become more liberal than the United States, where you still need the shots to get in. And I don't think that's the case in Canada anymore, is it?
No, it's not. No, they dropped that restriction earlier this year, I believe. It's been a crazy few years.
Yeah.
The COVID regime has really taken a toll on the healthcare system and healthcare workers. My whole family is healthcare workers. I'm an advanced care paramedic. I have two daughters that are paramedics. My wife's a registered nurse. And so, you know, this has played a huge mental toll, let's say, on us. This past year, for example, I've worked more overtime than I've worked at any point in my life. And that's largely because of staffing shortages everywhere. Healthcare workers are just utterly demoralized. The system is toxic. It's stressful. The rules keep changing. They treat you like an object of compliance rather than as a, you know, autonomous practitioner exercising clinical judgment or something like that. So as much as it's been demoralizing for the population in general, it's also been demoralizing for healthcare workers, and cracks are really have really shown in the last 2 years.
Canada is such an interesting case because on the one hand, there were really draconian measures implemented. And at the same time, there was public resistance, certainly in the form of that trucker convoy, on a level that we did not see in the United States. And yet the United States prides itself on being the home of the free and it's the best country in the world and all that. But when push came to shove, we were a bunch of mice. And yet it was Canada, where everything seemed hopeless, where we got this gigantic demonstration. I don't know how to reconcile that, frankly.
Well, I don't really either, other than maybe the mandates were more draconian here in Canada. And so it motivated a larger pushback.
Yeah.
But yeah, 2 years ago, I stepped down as leader of the Libertarian Party. And then I spent a good chunk of last year forming an organization called Fight for the Frontline, which helped many of my unvaxxed colleagues get back to work because of the lockdown. So we put an incredible amount of pushback and we were all over the media. We mounted a constitutional challenge. We finally got a meeting with the Alberta Health Minister. And shortly after that meeting, he agreed to bring all unvaxxed healthcare workers, including my colleagues, back to work. So, you know, you would rather do something more productive with your time than have to fight these authoritarian regimes. But they kind of left us no choice here in Canada. I didn't want to see my colleagues left without work. It didn't just affect their lives. It affected our lives. You know, as firefighters, we need to work as a team and we can't have people off, especially experienced firefighters and healthcare workers who, you know, you just can't replace them in a month. These are people who have had 10, 20 years experience that we look up to as leaders and valuable team members. So, like I said, it would have been nice to have focused on more productive things, but the state left us no choice.
Yeah, understood. Now, I can understand why the government would reverse a policy requiring the shots for healthcare workers. I can understand why it might do that. It might do that because there might have been enough non-compliance as to threaten the integrity of the whole system. And then you have no choice but to reverse course. But what's been difficult for me to understand, both in Canada and in the UK, is how abruptly, now maybe less abruptly in Canada, but more abruptly in the UK, the restrictions on foreign visitors being vaccinated or not were lifted. Because obviously, if your healthcare system collapses, you're going to suffer politically. And if you anger a substantial minority of the population, that could hurt you politically. But you're not hurt politically at all by foreigners who can't come in because they can't even vote. They are not a constituency at all. And yet, all of a sudden, they said, yeah, okay, you can come on in. Even though this kind of contradicts our whole propaganda about that we need the shots to keep us safe. These people are nobody's constituency. I would think they would have been left out in the cold forever.
Well, they're not a constituency, but they serve a constituency. For example, we rely heavily on migrant work from Mexico.
Oh, okay.
And we rely...
Tourism too?
Tourism, for sure. And also, you know, the oil and gas industry has a lot of border crossing to do and reliance on workers and consultants and different people from south of the border to come across into Canada and do business. So we rely heavily on trade and the movement of foreigners to our border. So I think that those constituencies probably had a lot to say about these restrictions.
Yeah, you know, thank you. I think you've actually helped me solve this mystery that I've been wondering about. My poor suffering listeners have heard me raise this probably 3 or 4 times now. And now I think I have a satisfactory answer. Although it's still leaves us with a bit of a mystery as to why the U.S. is so persistently pigheaded on this issue. But let's not talk about the U.S. Canada's depressing enough. Let's not bring any further bad news in. I want to ask you about something. You sent me an article, and I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/2259, pertaining to this assisted suicide question. But in there, there's a more general point about incentives within the Canadian healthcare system to have short visits with patients that in turn compromise the quality of care and diagnosis they're getting. Can we start actually by you explaining what those incentives are?
Sure. I think most of your audience as libertarians would agree that people shouldn't interfere in assisted suicide, that you should have the right to end your life, even if we think it's repugnant and not something we would choose to do. You know, a rational person who's suffering or something like that should have the right to be free of state interference. But in Canada, of course, we have state-mandated healthcare. And so any assisted suicide done by medical professionals is going to be done by the state. And then now you're facing a state program with all the perverse incentives that come along with that. And so the first perverse incentive would be that as a healthcare worker, I'm heavily incentivized to minimize work rather than maximize value for my patients. By that, I mean, as a paramedic, the thing that I get judged on, the thing that keeps me employed, that prevents me from getting fired, is the paperwork I produce for the state, the patient care report. And that allows the state to collect all sorts of data about how they ought to redistribute funding, make cases for growing the bureaucracy and increasing their power. And that paperwork takes a considerable amount of time, you know, probably 30 to 40 minutes per patient. And so I never get judged on the value I provide to the patient. The state could care less about that. They never ask patients, how was your care? They don't measure how my outcomes as a healthcare practitioner. Am I saving patients? Am I providing good care? Am I getting good feedback? Are patients having a great experience with me? Am I going that extra level for them? I don't get any promotions. I don't get any increases in pay. I don't get any increased opportunities by providing any value to my patients. What I get value out of is producing that paperwork for the state because that keeps me employed. So while I'm doing my job, which is writing paperwork, the patient has all sorts of demands. Can you help me with this pain? Can, you know, I get a urinal? Can you fluff up this pillow? I'm in a lot of pain over here. I'm having difficulty breathing. That takes me away from my job of producing paperwork. And so the paramedic who wins is the one who takes his time getting back out on the road to do more paperwork. The paramedic who ultimately wins is the one who stays home on stress leave and gets paid by the state to stay home and avoid work altogether. And in the community neighboring mine, Edmonton, we've had as much as 60% of full-time paramedics off at a given time on stress leave because they'd rather stay at home and collect a paycheck than have to deal with the COVID regime that they work under. And so all this is to say that our job isn't to maximize value for the patient. It's really to minimize work. And so now you add in assisted suicide to that equation, and you can understand why, you know, as my mom was recovering from surgery and suffering miserably, her nurse, who was at the end of a rope and frazzled and being torn 10 different ways, the 10th time my mom rang the call bell, she took me aside and suggested that MAID might be an option for mom and we should look into it.
MAID is the acronym is Medical right. Assistance in Dying.
Exactly, yeah. So she offered us access to a lethal injection when what my mom really needed was some hope. She didn't have a terminal illness. She could have recovered, but she was given this clear message by the healthcare system vis-a-vis this nurse working as an agent of that system that her situation was hopeless and that she ought to consider being put out of her misery. And so, again, I don't necessarily blame that nurse. I think she believed she was doing a good thing and her hands are essentially tied. Like I said, she can't provide the value. She's got a huge workload producing paperwork and checking boxes and following policies. And so to her, it probably was the most humane option, but it's a system that creates this incentive of minimizing work and punishes us, in fact, for maximizing value for the patient. So that is one perverse incentive. And we see this show up in all sorts of ways. Across Canada, we have physician orders, which are called goals of care. Now, you might ask why we have these goals of care, which are supposed to represent a collaborative kind of planning with your physician about what should happen if you lose capacity or you become ill, like how invasive, how aggressive should medical care be for you? Why would we have this when we already have legislation that supports something called advanced directives, which are supposed to be the patient outlining, you as a person would outline similar to a will, what you would want done in the event that you lack capacity? How should the medical establishment treat you? What kind of care would you like? How aggressive would you like that care? Would you just like comfort measures or would you like invasive ventilators and CPR and things like that? Well, the goals of care don't actually really represent a conversation with the patient, it turns out, because doctors only see patients for, on average, about 7 minutes in Canada. Doctors don't get paid anymore to provide quality of care. They're prohibited from doing things like providing concierge service, where they might spend an hour with a patient or do house calls or take phone calls or visit their patients in Emerge. They can't bill for those things. They can't get extra money for those things. So the only way that they can make a decent living is by this through quantities, by seeing one patient after another in very quick succession. So there's not a lot of time to talk with the patient and educate and create an environment that supports informed consent. So physicians rely on basically their own judgment. And so a lot of my patients who have these goals of care are surprised to learn that these goals of care actually restrict how much care I can provide them. It limits how much care I can provide them. And quite often these goals of care are informed by long-term care nurses who are, again, have the incentive to minimize work and strongly influence what the doctor writes on these goals of care. So that's just another example of how the perverse incentives are to minimize work and to minimize the level of care. And of course, that leads into this MAID service that really helps minimize work, right? Because if a high workload patient isn't there anymore, well, it definitely helps out the healthcare workers around them.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, I try to use this word sparingly, but it's almost demonic the way the logic of the system works, that first they make it so that it's impossible to run this system, and then they introduce this option where, well, it would sure make our lives a lot easier if we exercise this particular option. I mean, good grief. Now, I think the thing that's been alarming people in the US, and maybe this has actually been the case for several years in Canada, but we're only finding out about it now, that the MAID program is being offered to people somewhat, let's say, more promiscuously than before, in mm-hmm. that it's not confined to people who are in excruciating suffering at end of life or something like that, where you could at least understand, you know, regardless of your moral position on it, you could at least understand what the case for it is.
Right.
I get the logic behind it.
Yes.
But now, and I can't tell if what I'm seeing is a caricature of reality or what, but you're hearing stories about people who have mental health issues being told that it's an option for them. So what can you tell us
right.
about that?
Well, last year, there's a Supreme Court challenge or a Superior Court challenge in Quebec that challenged the constitutionality of MAID on the merits that there was a clause in the MAID legislation that said it needed to be a naturally foreseeable death for you to qualify for MAID. While there were some disabled people in Quebec that were suffering that didn't like that clause and thought it was discriminatory, and the Superior Court upheld it. And so they had to get rid of the naturally foreseeable death clause, which meant that now physically disabled people who weren't going to die anytime soon, foreseeably, could access assisted suicide. And the government looked at that and thought, well, if that couldn't survive a constitutional challenge, it's unlikely that mental health would be an exclusionary factor constitutionally as well. So as of March, they're allowing mental illness as something that could qualify you for assisted suicide. And we've already been seeing a large amount of this. Physical illness and mental deterioration kind of go hand in hand. It's usually people who are desperate and not doing so well mentally that opt in for MAID. And so what's happening in Canada, it's really prevalent in the veterans community. We've had at least 6 veterans call their Veterans Affairs office for support for their disability. Here are people that have served the state, whose bodies and brains have been kind of crushed by the state, asking for some help from the state, like wheelchair ramps or different things like that. And they're getting told, look, we can't really provide you a wheelchair ramp, or there's going to be a lot of bureaucracy and paperwork getting that done. But what we can do is provide you with MAID services if you're suffering. We can give you a lethal injection to spare you. And of course, these people aren't even asking for that, but it's being offered to them by someone who might think that's a humane option for them or just wants to let them know. But it's a horrible message for someone who's in a helping profession to, again, offer them hopelessness rather than some form of hope. There's a psychiatrist in Canada who recently wrote an op-ed talking about a patient that went to a family doctor in the middle of his psychiatric treatment. And he says, you know, this patient wants recovery and restored autonomy, not death. But the family physician offered him MAID, and that gave him the message that this psychiatric treatment won't work. There's an easier path than slow progress of recovery. And so this psychiatric patient is going to choose MAID rather than recovery. And I'm even seeing it start to pervade. Again, this is one of the other perverse things about the system, is that it sends us as practitioners a perverse signal. So now when I'm confronted with a suicidal patient, I heard one of my colleagues kind of joke the other day, like, with these suicidal patients, I don't know what we're supposed to do now. Are we supposed to offer them mental health support or offer them lethal injection? It's not clear anymore. You know, it just sends a perverse signal to us. When we're confronted with a suicidal patient, is our default assumption intervention for the purpose of saving a life, or is it to offer them service and facilitate their death? And this is very troubling, to say the least.
No kidding. No kidding. In fact, I think one of the points in your article that struck me the most was when we think about the source of the despair that so many people have felt in recent years, the source has been the state itself. And as you say,
yeah,
it should go without saying that if I hold you captive in your own home, isolate you from friends and family, rob you of joy and hope through threat of force, I might not be the best qualified person to be talking to you about suicide, right? I mean, there's something screwy about this.
Well, that's just right. I mean, it takes that old Harry Brown quote to the next level. You know, Harry Brown said, one thing government's good at is breaking your legs, giving you crutches, and then saying you're welcome. Well, now we break legs and offer a lethal injection. I'm sure Harry Brown is rolling over in his grave, but we've actually seen this play out. I mean, there was a 90-year-old lady in Canada last year who, when faced with another lockdown in her nursing home, chose MAID instead. She was a very social person, enjoyed connection with family. And during lockdown, her health deteriorated. And when health lockdown was lifted, she got better. And faced with another lockdown and not being able to see family, she said, just kill me. And the state obliged her. And we see this over and over again in Canada. In fact, there was a lady who was the face of this commercial that was kind of like a dystopian romanticization or fetishization of death, supporting this MAID program. They made it all out to be this beautiful thing, like she was choosing to die and she's spending all this time with family and on a beach in her last hours. Well, it turns out you do a little digging, and 6 months previous to that, she tells one of the news stations in Canada that she was actually choosing MAID because her options for treatment for hope were kind of crushed by the COVID regime. There were, you know, all these services were put down. One of the people actually in the constitutional challenge in Quebec that removed the naturally foreseeable death clause bumped up his suicide by a number of months when COVID hit because he said, well, I'm not going to be able to see my friends and family anyway, so I might as well die now. You know, I was going to spend my last months with that. So, yeah. So again, here you have this organization immiserating people and offering them escape from the misery that they created through lethal injection.
And as you indicated, this also extends to people who have served in the state's military, that sometimes that screws you up beyond repair. And so then they offer. So first we use you in pursuit of our whatever imperial ambitions. And then when you're too wrecked to be of any use to us anymore, we offer you the ultimate exit. It's just beyond belief. Absolutely beyond belief.
Right. And in fact, one veteran was told, and he was told this by the hospital ethicist, mind you. It's on a recording because he was recording these phone calls where he was continually being asked if he wanted MAID service, that he was told that his care is costing the hospital north of $1,500 a day and asked if he was interested in assisted dying. And so, again, proponents of MAID will say this has nothing to do with money or budgets or incentives, but these are central planners we're talking about. These are people that have to distribute these limited funds. And if they can save some money and redistribute those funds to something they see as more valuable than trying to support a miserable life that they broke, well, they're probably going to do that. So yeah, it's utterly horrific and, like you said, demonic.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. This is a somewhat unrelated question, but I feel like I need to ask you, given your occupation. I'm just curious about how would you say during COVID, your job changed? The things that you did or could not do or the way you did them changed because of all the restrictions?
Right. Well, prior to 2009, ambulance services in Alberta were provided by the municipality. So that created a fairly wide diversity. If you didn't like your employer, you could move to another one. You had a lot of engagement, let's say, in your job because, you know, if you felt there was a need in the community for a more advanced protocol or a new treatment regime, you could engage with your medical director and have some real influence over change and what was happening in your profession. Well, in 2009, when the province took over, that was all gone. And it became a very top-down authoritarian system where, again, we were treated like objects of compliance. And so this has been an issue for a while, but it was put on steroids like times a thousand during the COVID regime. And so, again, it was made very clear that we were objects of compliance. Changing rule sets on a weekly basis and different rules in different hospitals and constantly getting dumped on for not following a proper ritual or procedure at a hospital in terms of PPE or donning or doffing or when you're supposed to doff and then re-don, and, you know, it just changed constantly. And the rules were ridiculous. I mean, you had patients in isolation rooms where everything was sealed off because they screened positive for COVID, which just meant that they maybe had a cough or a fever or something, not that they had a positive test. But then these patients could walk out of their room, you know, walk down the hall past a bunch of people and go to a washroom. But yet I had to like don myself in high quality PPE just to enter that room. But this patient could leave freely, just little things like that. So it became very obvious to everyone working in the system how utterly ridiculous the COVID care and regime was being. And it made our job very difficult to stomach. And then you add on to that the emergencies of isolation that we were going to, opiate addiction, suicidal ideation and suicides, mental health issues. And then you add to that emergencies of dependency, let's call them, you know, where the acuity level of our calls dropped considerably because patients have been told, or people have been told for the last 2 years, don't trust your own judgment when it comes to your own body and your diseases and everything else. You're a disease vector, you're a germ vector by default. So no one trusted themselves. And so we're going for stuck farts and stubbed toes. And just 2 nights ago when I was on shift, you know, I went to someone with a stomach flu who took a THC edible and was feeling paranoid, but didn't need to go to the hospital. Someone else who felt like their CPAP machine was smothering them and had a panic attack and called the ambulance. None of the people I responded to the other night needed a hospital or an ambulance, yet they're so scared to trust their own judgment and to take responsibility for their own lives that it relies on us. So I guess you could say I've had a front seat row to the increasing fragility of just the general population.
It's so important, your testimony about all this, because healthcare is such a hard issue to debate with people, because it looks like you have two choices. You have the American system, which is absolutely screwed up beyond belief. I mean, it is screwed up beyond belief. And everybody thinks this is what happens when you have capitalism. But it is screwed up beyond belief. I mean, we have to admit, you should not be going to the doctor or the hospital, staying overnight and getting a bill for 50 grand. You know, that should absolutely not be happening. And there's no way. I mean, if I stayed in a hotel for a night with somebody keeping an eye on me, there's no reason it would come to that. So we have that. But then on the other hand, we have Canada, which is billed to us as an example of what happens when the state wisely directs healthcare resources and people don't have to worry about going bankrupt when a health event occurs. But there's no third alternative given to anybody, or it's never explained to anybody, A, the state incentives that yielded the U.S. system, or B, the problems with the supposedly perfect Canadian system. And you are, especially as somebody, as you say, with a front row seat to all this, you can actually give us the information.
Yeah, well, I mean, most Canadians, it's kind of political science 101 that you never challenge the universal health system in Canada. And it needs to be challenged right now because healthcare is largely illegal in Canada, outside the narrow window of what the state provides, and it's illegal. You know, so for example, before COVID's pandemic started, I had worked for a year as a project manager for my municipality, trying to implement something called the Community Care Paramedic Program, which would provide in-home care for seniors or people with low mobility who had kind of chronic health issues that would have urgent care needs. So you think of a congestive heart failure patient or a COPD patient who develops a cough, right? And you know that in a week, that cough is going to develop into a life-threatening pneumonia. But that person doesn't need to go to Emerge, but they don't have the mobility to go to their family doctor. So a community care paramedic goes in, does an assessment, draws up lab work, collaborates with the patient's primary care physician, facilitates a prescription, and does in-home treatment. It's a win-win-win system because it keeps patients out of Emerge, doesn't clog up the healthcare system, is ideal for the patient, and it helps the ambulance service out because now we don't have to continually transport these low acuity patients to the hospital. And our provincial health authority essentially shut it down. But now you cut to the pandemic a few months later, and here I have spent a year garnering relationships with all these networks of healthcare practitioners in my community. I've sold this idea. The politicians, like the local politicians, love the idea, but yet I can't get it off the ground. When it would have been a perfect program, especially at the start of the pandemic, when seniors were scared witless of this virus and they were all huddled in their homes with their healthcare needs going unattended. And I could have started a family enterprise, even a nonprofit or charity, doing this work with the four of us that are doing this. And I could have had that up and running in a week, helping people out in my community, but that is illegal to do. And so you multiply, and this is just one person and one family of healthcare workers in Canada. We have something like 3 million healthcare workers in Canada. Think of the unrealized potential of all these people who have some innovative, interesting idea that really serve a need in the community, and it's just utterly illegal for us to do so. And then it's no wonder that you see 10-hour waits in Emerge. You see no ambulances available to respond. You see surgeries postponed. You see healthcare needs going unaddressed. We have to make healthcare legal. So that's the bottom line.
Folks, Tim is obviously a smart and good guy, and you should follow him. His website is timmoen.net. That's M-O-E-N, timmoen.net. I'm linking to that along with the specific article we've been talking about at tomwoods.com/2259. Just out of curiosity, Tim, where are you located?
I'm located in a community called Sherwood Park, just east of Edmonton.
Edmonton. Okay. I was just wondering because the only time I've ever been to Canada was, I think we stopped in Halifax on a cruise. And so I had a matter of a few hours to walk around. Oh, no. I beg your pardon. We did also go to, we did make a stop in British Columbia on another cruise. But again, this is not really a serious visit. I was all set. I had a trip to Toronto booked for 2020. I was all set because Michael Malice has been telling me over and over, Toronto is a great city. You really have to go see it. So I thought, okay, I'll go do that. That did not happen.
Well, most Canadians hate Toronto, but...
well, you know, a lot of Americans hate New York City, but I love it.
That's fair. You know, Alberta is a great place to visit. We have a new premier who is taking a page out of DeSantis's playbook. You know, she's apologized to the unvaxxed for the worst discrimination she's ever seen.
Yeah.
And she's created a Sovereignty Act for Alberta, which protects us from federal overreach. Saskatchewan's following suit as well. So I see the pendulum shifting. So I think I'm fairly white-pilled on Alberta. And, you know, I'm in the middle of Michael Malice's new book as well. So it's given me a little bit of hope. But Alberta would love to have you, Tom. Anytime you choose to come to Canada, consider Alberta.
Okay. I actually will consider that. I'll have to try to consider that during one of the... I think you guys have the inverse of the weather that I have in... My guess is in Florida because it's unlivable 7 months out of the year. I mean, it is just unlivable.
It is.
It is so
hot. It was
hot.
Minus 30 last week.
Yes, okay. So you guys have you have the opposite unlivability problem. I mean, I can't even set foot out of my house for most of the year, which is part of the reason I travel so much is to go to more favorable climes. But the thing is, it's the political climate that has brought me... I mean, I was in Florida before that, but this is why I'm planning to stay for the foreseeable future, is that the political climate is much more reliable than it is in a lot of other places. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I am hoping to make my way to Canada one of these days, and I will not rule out Alberta, but I will probably also head to apparently the city all Canadians hate, because my curiosity will get the better of me. But thanks so much, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. The Tom Woods Show will resume January 4th, 2023.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.